Welcome to Whiskey Rebellion. This is David Silkenet in Edinburgh. I'm joined as always by Frank Cogliano. How are you doing today, Frank?
I'm doing great, David. What about yourself?
I'm doing pretty well. Beautiful day outside. Wonderful time of year here in Scotland.
Yeah, when the sun's out, this is the finest city in the world.
Right. So, this weekend, the big news story was the royal wedding between Meghan Markle and Prince Harry. Millions of people around the world, including millions of Americans, tuned in to watch the royal wedding. Frank, as a American expat living in Scotland, did you spend Saturday watching the royal wedding?
I did not. Not one second.
Not one second.
What about you?
I didn't watch the royal wedding either.
Right, so this is the ultimate example of mansplaining. Two middle-aged idiots are going to opine about something they didn't see.
Speak for yourself, Frank.
Okay.
But I think we have a question. I mean, the question where I think we're going to try to wrestle with today is why are Americans so interested not only in this royal wedding, but also in sort of British royalty as a whole? If you think about, you know, the Netflix series The Crown.
See any of that? No.
I have watched. That's actually pretty good. Or you know, the King's Speech, or just the persistent interest. You know, some of the on social media, the people who seem most interested, at least among my friends, who are most interested in the royal wedding, were not my British friends, but my American friends. So I'm going to see if we can make sense why Americans seem to care about this.
Yes, yes, let's do that, because this is my particular beef. I've been boycotting royal weddings since 1982 in the face of American enthusiasm for them. And I want to make clear, I need to make something very, very clear at the outset. And first of all, I'm only speaking for myself and not for you, as is always the case. But you and I are in a particular category here because we are guests in this country.
Yes, they're very kind to let us live
here. They are very kind to let us live here. This is a country I've lived in for 26 years now, and which I love very much. So my attitude towards the British Constitution, which includes the monarchy, of course, is that British people are entitled to govern themselves in any way they see fit. I may have opinions about those decisions, but it's certainly within their purview to have any kind of governmental system they like, and I'm grateful to be a guest here. My beef is with Americans and their enthusiasm for the monarchy.
Mm.
So I want to stipulate that at the outset. So this isn't anti-British or anti-monarchical so much as critical of my countrymen and women and their enthusiasm for the monarchy. I also want to, I think I have to offer a couple of qualifiers, because from what I did pick up about the wedding, because it was impossible to ignore in terms of social media and news reports, try as I might, is this is actually the wrong time to have this conversation to some extent, because for a number of reasons. First of all, Meghan Markle, of course, is American, so there was a particular American interest in this, and it shouldn't be surprising, therefore, that Americans were interested in this particular story.
Although they seem just as interested in this as William and Kate. And
exactly. No, no, I would...
Chuck and Di.
Yes,
and
yeah, and as I think we're going to talk about, this has very deep roots. But in this particular case, it seems more justified. Secondly, for persons of their ilk... Royals and celebrities, they seem more likable.
You are disdainful of both.
Well, no, not of them. They seem more likable than most. I'm disdainful of royals and celebrities, yes, but they seem to be fairly unobjectionable people.
Okay.
And so my criticism isn't really directed at them. And thirdly, one of the things that did occur, and this is a serious point, and I saw this a lot on social media and among my friends and friends of friends and so on, is the significance of this wedding because of her mixed race background for many persons of color in Britain and the United States in particular.
And the sermon given by an African-American
Episcopal. And the response to that in that particular context was such that, again, although I might be critical of monarchy as an institution and the American enthusiasm for monarchy, there were certain kind of mitigating factors in this particular case, apparently, because I didn't see it, that make this not the best example. You're right. We could have recorded this podcast several years ago when William and Kate got married. But I think, so I do want to kind of temper any criticism with those three qualifiers. However...
Okay, this
I
is where the
quite
rant
considered
begins.
Opinions okay. about why this is actually why American enthusiasm for monarchy is a problem. We'll get to those, but do you want to offer a bit of history for all this, David?
Well, so if we think back to you know, the colonial era, you know, American colonial British colonists in what becomes the United States, had some enthusiasm for British monarchy. They celebrated the king's birthday. They named half of the colonies. It seems like all the southern colonies are named after British royalty. They named many of their cities after members of the royal family. Obviously, then the revolution happens and they topple the statue of George III and all the kinds of things. What is the revolution? You're the expert on the revolution. What do the revolutionary generation think about the royal family and monarchy generally?
Well, those are two different questions, but obviously related. They're ambivalent. I mean, they grew up, as you said, David, in a monarchical culture and in a culture that was suffused with monarchy.
Hmm.
And they were subjects. I mean, the real one of the real achievements of the American Revolution is it transforms some Americans, not all, and we know the limitations, some Americans, from subjects into citizens. And yes, that's a really important intellectual and ideological development. However, the royal vestiges remain. One only needs to look at the powers vested in the president,
sure,
which are derived from monarchy, including the pardoning power. But there's a real ambivalence. So somebody like George Washington was aware of that, and we've talked about Washington's presidency in the past, but was aware of the precedents that he would be setting, but also aware of the kind of monarchical aspects of the presidency and why they were both important as far as investing that office with power, but also something to be concerned about.
Yeah. And the more radical people, I think, in the revolution, like Thomas Paine, you know, writing Common Sense, one of the things he says there is not only is this monarch a disaster, but all monarchy is by nature disastrous and wrong-headed.
An armed French bastard and his armed banditti are a pretty paltry original. It's exactly my favorite line in Common Sense to describe William the Conqueror and the origins. Basically, Paine's argument is, look, if you look at the origins of any monarchy, they're basically gangsters from the Middle Ages who started these
dynasties. They gave them fancy titles.
Yeah, and you know, why? And the problem is, their descendants, it's a lottery who you get to be your ruler, and it's absurd. Now, that's Paine's position. It's a position with which I have a great deal of sympathy. Jefferson shares that skepticism of monarchy. John Adams is interesting because Adams takes the view that, you know, to our minds, absurd debate in the first Congress over the title for the president and the titles for the vice president as well. And Adams is an advocate that the president needs to have a certain title to give power and respect, and as evidence for respect for the office. And because Adams, who's more conservative than, say, Jefferson, recognizes the utility of monarchy and the fact that it guarantees stability and order and things like this, and therefore respect in hierarchy and respect for hierarchy are important. And so there are these monarchical vestiges that survive in the early Republic. It's not like on July 4th, 1776, Americans completely forswore monarchy and their monarchical elements of their culture, and they've persisted, and enthusiasm for monarchy has persisted. I mean, you know more about the 19th century than I do, but you know, if you want to catch my forward,
you know,
a little
thinking
bit
about a point in time when, you know, Americans start becoming enamored with monarchy, or at least with the British monarchy. You know, I think Queen Victoria is critically important. Obviously, she is, you know, reigns for, you know, the second 2/3 of the 19th century. And you see this when she's engaged to be married to Albert, because Americans get deeply enthused and interested in her engagement and wedding. But they're a bit uncertain about what this means. There's a great New York diarist and lawyer, George Templeton Strong, who writes about the enthusiasm that Americans had for Victoria. He said, like, all the newspapers are covering this every day. It's on the front page. And he says, I almost quote his diary here. He says, the upcoming wedding of Queen Victoria is, quote, doubtless very interesting and important to Her Majesty's loyal subjects, but to us Republicans is or ought to be rather dull and profitless.
That's me applauding George Templeton Strong, ladies and gentlemen.
Well, and the irony is that Strong actually talks about the engagement and the wedding over and over in his diary. So he, I think he's wrestling with this himself. He says, like, we're interested in this, even though we know we shouldn't be. That, you know, the marital affairs of a monarchy from a country that's built out of rejecting monarchy and embracing democracy and republican forms of government, you know, they should not care at all, but they do. And I think, you know, part of this is they're now a generation removed from the revolution, so the sort of real diehards of people who are rejecting monarchy are you know, gone. And I think there's something that you know, a romantic ethos that grips America, because it seems very distant in some ways. And one great example of this is in 1860, when Victoria's oldest son, Edward, who was the Prince of Wales, and he's later Edward the VII, visits the United States. And the background of this trip is that there were some Canadians who fought with Britain. Canada, of course, is that part of the British Empire. Canadians who fought in the Crimean War. The Canadians afterwards said, "Dear Queen Victoria, we really loved fighting for you in the Crimean War. Would you like to come and visit us, please?" And Queen Victoria basically said, "No, I have no interest in traveling over an ocean to visit you Canadians." But some of her advisors, including some political leaders, recommended that she send one of her sons, and when Edward reached the age of 18, Victoria sent him off to go tour Canada, and some of her political advisors said, like, while he's in Canada, it'd be a good idea if he also visited the United States, because the United States is rising as a global power. And Victoria initially apparently didn't like this idea, but she also didn't particularly get along very well with her son, so she said, fine, go and visit the United States too. It'd be, you know, politically expedient. And when he comes to the United States, Americans are deeply enthusiastic about seeing an actual member of the royal family. You know, he gets greeted by something on the order of 30,000 people when he goes to Detroit, 50,000 people when he goes to Chicago. He travels throughout northern tier of states, goes to Washington, D.C., visits the Capitol, goes to Mount Vernon. This is in 1860, so of course this is right in the midst of probably the most important presidential election in American history, that he has this visit. He briefly goes to Richmond. Some Southerners want to take him to a plantation so he can sort of give his stamp of approval to slavery. He says, no, I really don't want to do that. Goes to New York, has an enormous parade in New York, and is cheered by basically the entire population of the city, except, of course, by the Irish community in New York, who were protesting British treatment of Irish citizens in Ireland. Of course, this part was part of Great Britain. And in fact, there were some Irish militia units that were supposed to march in front of the Prince of Wales and end up getting court-martialed for refusing. But I think the enthusiasm that Americans had for seeing him, even if their image of what they thought they would see when they saw him, was something of a disappointment. There was a great cartoon in Harper's Weekly, I think, that showed on one side of the page what they thought they would get when the Prince of Wales showed up, and the other half of the page is what they actually got. And what they thought they were going to get was this kind of guy dressed in Renaissance clothing, you know, with a sword and a horse, and this sort of romantic ideal of what a prince is. And the other side, it's a guy in a raincoat and an umbrella smoking a cigar who seems kind of bored with himself. But Victoria, and you know, I think this trip in particular sort of symbolizes this sort of turning point in which Americans, you know, a generation removed from the revolution, are really enamored with the British royalty. You see this later on when, you know, Victoria dies in 1901. You know, there are bells rung around the country to commemorate her death, you know, and it seems in some ways very odd to commemorate the death of a monarch of a foreign country, especially a foreign country the United States had fought two wars with. But I think by 1900, the relationship, 1901, the relationship is very different at that point. What about things in the 20th century, Frank? How we sort of narrate it?
Century, I mean, it's interesting because I think there's a close parallel with the American response to Victoria that you've just outlined so ably, and its response to Queen Elizabeth II, who's now reigned even longer than Victoria. Mm. And there's a great deal of affection and enthusiasm in the United States, I think that's safe to say, for Elizabeth II. And that's given a lot of energy to the current enthusiasm for the royal family in the United States to this day. She's visited the United States many times. Of course, her reign has coincided with the so-called special relationship, which we've talked about in this podcast before. And that's really important, not just on a cultural level, although it is important on a cultural level, but also on a kind of security and strategic level. And so American presidents have often sought the kind of vicarious grandeur that being seen with Queen Elizabeth provides them. She's very popular in the United States. Her family is very popular in the United States, by and large. Princess Diana was very popular in the United States. I think that the kind of enthusiasm for the family is I think what happened with Victoria has, has been continued.
You know, going before, slightly before, you know, our current, the current monarch, I think Americans got very interested in the abdication crisis in 1936 when Edward VIII proposed marriage to Wallis Simpson, an American divorcee, which has interesting sort of parallels to today with the more recent wedding. And was forced to abdicate, and his brother George VI, who was Queen Elizabeth's father. Am I getting all the genealogy right here, Frank?
Don't care.
Okay, so when George VI, who was
you're going to have to check this afterwards and issue a corrective.
No, I think I'm right here. When George VI, who was the, for those people who watch these kinds of films, the monarch in the King's Speech thing that was very popular several years ago. And George VI visits the United States in 1939, and you think about what it means for the British monarch to visit the United States in 1939, thinking about the special relationship, part of that visit was about shoring up the relationship between the United States government and the British government after German aggression in the rest of Europe and the sort of prelude to World War II. So I think we can see, that relationship and the interest in the symbolic value of the monarchy for Americans starting then.
Yeah, I mean, one of the, there is a Republican movement here in the UK. It's not terribly strong, it must be said. But one of the debates that happens about the so-called value of the monarchy, one of the points that's made is that they are a kind of vehicle for British soft power.
Mm-hmm.
And relatively popular around the world, especially the younger generation. And whether it's George VI or Queen Elizabeth II or her grandchildren traveling around the world, and particularly the United States, they do generate a great deal of affection. I think that's true. And at particular moments, as you say, 1939 or during the Cold War, that's been especially significant. And I think again, we saw some echoes of that in the, and I'm basing this on news reports, in the wedding this weekend, as I said, at a cultural level, with the response to Meghan Markle and her background and her family, her mother in particular, and as you say, the American Anglican prelate who gave the homily. There was something more going on there than simply a wedding, it seems to me, in significant ways. My slight discomfort with that, and again, it's not for me to tell people how to respond to this, but I can have my opinion, but it won't matter. But particularly the way that people of color in both countries have responded, and around the world, is people say, oh, she was born in America and now she's been ennobled. Well, in my view, she's not ennobled by marrying this ginger prince. She was a noble,
Now you're alienating not only our royalist Scots listeners.
She was ennobled, as Jefferson would say, by being born a human being.
Ah, yes.
And she has certain inalienable rights. And so I don't think she was ennobled by virtue of her wedding. Again, I want to make clear, these seem to be two perfectly nice people. I wish them well. But, you know, I was slightly discomforted by this notion that she was somehow ennobled by this. She was formerly ennobled and that she's now the Duchess of Sussex, but I don't mean that. I mean, there was a sort of response that somehow she'd arrived. And let's not forget that the British monarchy is very closely tied to the British Empire, which was all about keeping people around the world down. And denying them their rights.
Right, sure, sure, sure.
Especially non-white people for centuries. So let's not forget what the other aspects of the monarchy. So I was a little discomforted by that. But the kind of soft power aspect of the monarchy and the soft power influence of the monarchy has been a great boon to Britain. There's no doubt about that. And especially in the United States.
Well, one of the things that strikes me with regards to the relationship and this sort of soft power is there's a, and you see this somewhat in the 19th century, but especially the 20th century, a distinction in the minds of Americans between the policies of the British government and the actions of the monarchy, which is very distinct from, say, the Revolutionary era. When you look at the Declaration of Independence, Jefferson et al. Blames the policies of the British government on the British crown. And now I think most Americans just, you know, so deeply disentangle those two phenomena that they don't blame Brexit on, you know, Prince Harry.
Right. I mean, one of the arguments that monarchists, and not just in the UK, but in countries that still retain monarchies, in Western Europe at least, make in favor of them, is it's very useful to have a head of state who's separated from the head of government.
Mm.
In the United States, the president, of course, is both the head of state and the head of an administration. Mm-hmm. In a parliamentary system, in a constitutional monarch, of course, Theresa May is the head of the government in the United Kingdom, but the Queen is the head of state. And that separating those two things serves a very useful function. And you only need to look at how complicated, and I'm using that word to try and be neutral, how complicated American politics are right now because of the conflation of Donald Trump's roles as both head of state and head of government, and how that complicates American diplomacy at the moment. Separating those two roles certainly has a benefit. And again, if we're considering the constitutional arrangement in this country, that seems to work pretty well. So, this speaks to the fact that the modern monarchy seems to work perhaps better than some of its antecedents. The problem during the Revolution, I mean, the Declaration of Independence's indictment of George III is problematic in all kinds of ways, but the king had much more power than Queen Elizabeth does today. Although the Queen does have substantial wealth and retains, you know, this is a monarchy. This is a monarchy. It's a constitutional monarchy. The monarch's powers are limited in important ways, but in significant ways, but it's still a monarchy. But again, the royalist argument in favor would be that separation actually works quite well. And when you have an unpopular head of government, it's very useful to have a relatively popular, seemingly benign head of state. Now, that argument, at least in the UK, it seems to me, as somebody who's lived here for more than a quarter of a century, to a large extent is closely conflated with the affection for Queen Elizabeth, or the monarch somebody less popular. Prince Charles does not seem to be as popular as either his mother or his children. But Prince Charles is next in line, and Thomas Paine would say, well, duh, that's the system you have, that's why it doesn't work. I'm not sure Prince Charles will necessarily be as popular a monarch as his mother was, or as his son William might be. But who knows, maybe he'll grow into the role at age 67 or whatever he is.
I'm still trying to puzzle out why Americans, you know, thinking about starting with Victoria, really become enamored with monarchy, when you would think that that would run contrary to all the sort of values that Americans teach their children about, the values of, anybody can grow up to be president, these kinds of ideas about egalitarianism and the sort of absurdity of inherited titles and whatnot. You know, I'm trying to make sense of the popularity of monarchical structures in a government that's predicated upon its rejection of monarchy. And I've, you know, tried to sort of puzzle this out, and my daughter's explanation was it's, you know, Walt Disney's fault. And, you know, there may be some truth to that in as much as you have things like, you know, the Brothers Grimm importing mythology that gets read to every American child since 1820 onwards, about that all have princesses and princes and they all end happily ever after with a wedding. And this seems to replicate that. But is there anything more to make sense of all this?
Well, I might be the wrong person to ask that, but I think Walt Disney might be a manifestation of it rather than the cause.
Well, that's the point I was making. Yeah. There's...
Again, well, first of all, I think, you know, monarchy in some way, shape, or form has characterized much of human history.
To be sure.
Republicanism is relatively, certainly in its modern iteration, is relatively new. And so monarchy might fulfill some kind of human need.
Okay.
And in the United States, of course, we have a republic. Democracy's always been a contested term. And although we, you know, the Declaration of Independence is the kind of mission statement of the country, the country's always had elites based on wealth and inherited power. And let's not forget how important celebrity is in American culture.
Mm.
Whether it's the British royal family, who are global celebrities, or athletes, whether it's Tom Brady and Giselle, or Brangelina when they were together, and the Kardashians. I mean, there's always been a kind of celebrity culture that's been incredibly powerful in the United States, and I think this is part of that as well. Look, people like to follow good-looking young rich people.
So, but
there's an element of that.
But if that's the case, then we shouldn't be angry that frustrated or whatever the right term is that Americans are interested in this wedding because it's a wedding of wealthy, famous, good-looking people surrounded by other wealthy, famous, good-looking people. I mean, is this just a celebrity wedding that happens to have, you know, is this different than the Kim and Kanye kind of relationship, any other famous celebrity couple? Or is Americans just love the royal families because they're celebrities?
Well, I think that's part of it. And I think then there is the romance about princes and princesses and all that kind of stuff. But I have a list of reasons why this is nefarious.
Okay,
not necessarily Meghan and Harry, but why the institution, and more importantly, why the affection for the institution in the United States is insidious.
Okay, lay it on.
Would you like to hear it?
Yeah.
Okay. First of all, we've always had a dynastic tendency in American politics, which I think is damaging and problematic, whether it was the Adamses or the Roosevelts or the Tafts, or much more recently, the Kennedys, Clintons, and Bushes. My social media feeds are full of kind of romantic pictures of Bobby Kennedy because we're approaching the 50th anniversary of his assassination. But it's being presented as a sort of Kennedy tragedy. So we have the kind of... This is on the left and the right. So we have the Kennedys on the left, the Clintons on the left, the Bushes on the right. I think that dynastic tendency is problematic, and I think it's a monarchical vestige to some extent. I think there are other reasons why dynasties are created in terms of the accretion of power and wealth and so on, but I think that dynastic tendency is a problem. Last week, we saw Jared and Ivanka in Jerusalem at the opening of the new American embassy in Jerusalem and the attendant problems that occurred. I would argue, you know, Jared and Ivanka, notwithstanding their titles as special advisors or whatever they have no standing or should have no standing in the American government, but their presence was frankly monarchical.
Yes.
They were there representing their father and father-in-law.
Like the Prince of Wales visiting in 1860.
Exactly. I mean, I would argue, and I won't say, that Jared and Ivanka are on a spectrum with William and Kate. in kind of cultural terms.
Sure.
And that's problematic. I think people might agree that Jared and Ivanka taking that public role is problematic, whereas William and Kate have a constitutional role and that's okay. But you can't have one without the other, or at least we can't in the United States, and I think that's problematic. I would also say the worship of celebrity that's closely tied up with this helped give us a reality show president. And we're dealing with the consequences of that. So that aspect of the culture is problematic. Now, I'm not saying everyone who got up to watch Harry and Meghan and felt good about it is necessarily responsible for the worst aspects of American politics, but I think these are the reasons it's insidious. And finally, we had President Trump's tweet overnight where he hereby demands investigations of the Department of Justice.
Mm.
Now, that's been that's a problematic tweet in all kinds of ways, but frankly, he's acting in the monarchical tradition that's embedded in the presidency. Now, I think he's gone too far with that, but I think there are reasons why the revolutionary generation, the revolution was like fundamentally against monarchy, and the revolutionaries fundamentally were anxious about monarchy. And I think our, and by our, I'm talking about Americans in this case, affection for monarchy can be problematic and has its insidious aspects. So that's why I object. I have nothing against Harry and Meghan. I think they're fine. And if David Beckham wants to go to their wedding and George Clooney, well, fine. I don't care. And it did make a lot of people happy. So I don't want to be too curmudgeonly about this, but I think monarchy, the American affection for monarchy is fundamentally at odds with the American political system and democracy.
Mm. I would have,
So, do you have a response? Sorry, that was a long rant.
One thing it strikes me is I've found far more enthusiasm for it among my American friends than especially my Scottish friends.
Oh, Scotland! Yeah, we're in the right place.
Yeah, that you know, on the one hand, I'm mostly dismissive of it as thinking this is just a celebrity wedding, and celebrity weddings are going to attract celebrities, and it's you know, innocuous. And I'm deeply uninterested in it, just like I'm uninterested in other celebrity weddings because I really just don't care and have other things to do. You know, I have no interest in who's wearing what and who's, you know, those kinds of trivialities, at least from my perspective. See my previous episode ranting about first ladies' dresses. My deep disinterest in fashion is apparent every time you look at me. But I mean, I think you're right that there is, it speaks to a kind of affection for monarchical structures that seem to run contrary to, you know, the ethos of the revolution, or at least parts of the ethos of the revolution, because the revolution wasn't one thing, and contrary to, you know, a healthy republic, which is based upon merit and work, not based on the accident of birth. And I think I do see some of the parallels you're drawing here with, you know, the Trump administration and the ways in which he is, you know, the imperial presidency as an idea, you know, began as a, you know, a metaphor. The presidency was like an emperor, but now increasingly the power of the executive branch is so centralized in the president that he's starting to talk like an emperor. And that's deeply troubling for the, you know, health of the republic.
One of our cherished beliefs, and it's a cliche, every time there's a new administration, we celebrate the peaceful transfer of power in the United States. And first of all, this is slightly mythic because, as you know better than me, there was a not very peaceful transfer of power in 1860 and 61, so we don't have an unbroken record here. But in general, there's this kind of, this phrase is always invoked, the peaceful transfer of power. Now, in other political systems, there is a peaceful transfer of power. When there's a general election in the UK, if the party out of power wins, you know, within hours, the new prime minister moves into Downing Street. In a monarchy, there's a transfer of power, usually peaceful, although history is littered with dynastic wars, but we don't really have those anymore. But what makes the peaceful transfer of power so profound and important in the American system is it's democratically conferred from one person to another. It's not dynastic. And this flies in the face of that. And I think it's problematic. Now, again, it works in other cultures. It works in Scandinavia, where they've got very happy and functioning democracies that have but also their constitutional monarchies. It works pretty well in the UK, you know, and for the UK. I think in the United States, the monarchical tendency in the absence of a monarch is potentially problematic. And again, I'm not saying I have many, many friends, and I'm shouting out now to my good friend George Boudreau, who's the biggest monarchist I know on Facebook. Hello, George. I told you I'd mention you. You know, I've got many friends like George who took great joy in the events on Saturday, and I don't really begrudge anybody that, notwithstanding my stated position here.
But you also don't watch the Queen's speech every year.
No, I've never seen the Queen's speech. I've lived in Britain for 26 years, and I've never seen the Queen's speech.
Actually, we should probably tell our American listeners what the Queen's speech is.
It's something she does on Christmas.
Of course you wouldn't know, because you don't.
She
says fairly banal things every Christmas about
the state of the country and
being kind to one another.
Yeah, it's fine. It's fine. But I don't partake of that. And I choose not to. And I live in a country where the United Kingdom, where I can choose not to do so. This is a democratic country as well. I'm not sure we have much more to say. There's one more thing. I have one more thing to say. I have great hopes in Meghan Markle for this reason.
Okay.
She may be the solution to our tax problems as expats. Because Americans abroad are subject both to a tax regime that's unfair. For a country born of a tax revolt, it's ironic that we're one of the few countries that taxes its citizens abroad. I don't have any hope that that's necessarily going to change. But also there are quite stringent financial reporting requirements now on Americans abroad that are frankly quite problematic and to which she will be subject.
Did she not renounce her American citizenship?
Doesn't get you out of it. If you renounce your American citizenship, you still have to make these declarations for at least 10 more years. So this could be solved relatively easily by Congress. The legislation that requires us to fill out all this onerous paperwork to declare all of our... You have to declare all your bank accounts abroad to the U.S. Treasury. And theoretically, every institution with whom you have an account has to open its books to the U.S. Treasury. Yes. This could be addressed, and maybe it will be addressed once the House of Windsor is subject to it.
Yes.
So I look forward, because two of my favorite institutions, the House of Windsor and the IRS, might come into conflict. And so Meghan Markle's citizenship, even if she renounces her U.S. citizenship, may finally call attention to this, and maybe we'll get some relief.
My little bit of hope with her is she had to take the life in the UK test recently. Did you have to take the life in the UK
test? I did not.
Okay, so I did have to take it in order to stay in this very fine country. And it's a remarkable exam. You can take versions of it online. I highly recommend our listeners try it. Because it's a very different kind of exam than the American test you'd have to take for citizenship or for permanent residency. In as much as it includes not only constitutional questions, but questions about British culture, questions about what kind of information you have on your dog tags, questions about how the court system works, all kinds, and sports, which is a and supposedly Meghan Markle passed her test, so that's good for her.
Well, she's a Northwestern University graduate. She's no dummy.
No, but it's a hard test. There's a big old book you got to study from. Listeners, give the test a shot. What's your last drop?
My last drop, David, I want to recommend a book to you. It's by Thomas Mullen, and it's called Dark Town. And this book is fabulous. He's just published a sequel, the title of which I can't recall. It's a detective story, and I read a lot of detective novels. It's set in Atlanta in 1948, and the main protagonists are some of the first black policemen on the Atlanta police force right after the Second World War. And it gives you an insight into what life was like in Atlanta for African Americans, basically under apartheid, and the difficulty these policemen faced. I mean, there is a murder mystery aspect to it, or a kind of detective story is the focus of it. It's fabulous. It reminds me a little bit of Walter Mosley's Rollins novels, which are set in L.A. in the same time period. It's a great book. In fact, I stayed up so late last night reading it that I overslept and missed my gym session this morning. So that's the strongest endorsement I could possibly give. It's a fine book. Thomas Mullen, Dark Tower.
Okay.
What about you, David? What's yours?
So I want to endorse a national historic site, and that is the Eisenhower House in Gettysburg, Pennsylvania. Eisenhower, by the way, was the first American president to meet the current monarch, Queen Elizabeth II, when she visited in 1957. Eisenhower bought this house in Gettysburg in 1950, basically had to remodel it during most of his presidency, but then retired there and spent the last few years of his life in Gettysburg, among other places. He lived in several different locations then. I think many people listening to the show may have visited Gettysburg, but don't know about the Eisenhower House, which is not actually far from the Confederate lines, and you can go and visit it. And one of the special perks you will get if you visit this summer is there's a chance that the person leading the tour of the Eisenhower House will be a young man I know very well, and that's my son Chamberlain, who is working at the Eisenhower House as a tour guide this summer.
Excellent.
So, yes, if you want to go and say hi to him, he will be leading tours throughout the months of June, July, August, and into September.
Excellent.
All right.
Great. Cheers, David. And we should wish Harry and Meghan well.
Best of luck.
Yeah, good luck.
The Whiskey Rebellion is hosted by David Silkenet and Frank Cogliano. David is a senior lecturer in American history at the University of Edinburgh, and Frank is professor of American history and Dean International for North America at the University of Edinburgh. The Whiskey Rebellion is available on iTunes, Stitcher, and Podbean. You can follow the show on Twitter at Whiskey Rebel Pod and like the show on Facebook for updates about current and future episodes.